When the raunchy, violent, very R-rated Deadpool came out in 2016, it didn't sound like a surefire hit. The movie starred Ryan Reynolds as a Marvel Comics anti-hero who seeks vengeance against the man who gave him superpowers and a kind of immortality, as well as disfiguring scars from head to toe.
That movie made $783 million worldwide, so a sequel was inevitable. Deadpool 2 introduces Josh Brolin as a time-traveling badass named Cable, as well as Julian Dennison as a troubled teen with deadly powers. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. We've got all the wacky, wisecracking, fourth-wall-breaking ultra-violence you can handle this week on Pop Culture Happy Hour. Also with us from NPR member station WAMU right here in Washington, D.C., is Daisy Rosario. Hi, Daisy.
Hi, Stephen.
And in our fourth chair is writer and film critic Chris Klimek. Hi, Chris.
Lady, gentlemen, hello.
It is good to have you here. We're going to go right into it. Glenn, where did you stand on Deadpool?
Mm-hmm.
And what did you think of Deadpool 2?
Both of these films are not only critic-proof, but critique-proof. You come at either of these two films with even the minorest quibble. The entire franchise just rolls over on its back and exposes its belly and says, What? It's just entertainment, bro. They're just jokes, bro. What, you mad, bro? You mad? And it's like, I'm not mad. I just have a couple quibbles. Like, that's the mission statement, right? That's the ethos. There are, in this film, jokes. Sincere, crafted jokes that feel like the product of human thought and effort. There are not many of those. There are many lazy references.
Sure.
And so this is Family Guy the movie, right? The thing is, though, when your brain recognizes something out of context, neurons fire, that sit right next to the neurons that fire when something is legitimately funny. So to me, who cares about that very much, like, jokes mean something, references don't, but they still get a reaction. In our audience, we saw it with a screening audience, this film got huge reaction. To many people, that distinction that I'm making is a distinction without a difference. To me, it matters. This thing's going to make a mint, and people are going to love it who are not me.
All right. Thank you, Glenn. Daisy, what did you think?
I loved it.
There you go.
And you're a big fan of Deadpool 1.
I really enjoyed the first Deadpool, yeah. I mean, I just do feel like the movie, it's so similar to how the comics just kind of know who they're playing to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I hate Family Guy, so mm-hmm. that one felt a little mean. That's the only part I'm going
to
give you a hard time about. But no, I just feel like it gets the fatigue that you probably feel if you like superhero movies, but also can still be overwhelmed by how many there are.
Right.
It pokes fun at that. There's a lot of references, but that's not really, you know, out of character for what the comics are. So I really just think it's a lot of fun, and I feel like it knows who it's for. I mean, I think that's one of the benefits of them having made a low-budget one to begin with.
Right.
But I did feel like with this one, at the very least, I didn't feel that they just went, okay, we're going to make a sequel, obviously. Like, why wouldn't we? I feel like they also got what worked about the first one for people and did try to develop that stuff a little bit more. But, I mean, referential humor is a huge part of what it is. So.
Sure. How about you, Chris?
I guess I'm right in the middle of you two. Like, I don't really want to endorse this strongly. And this isn't really what I want David Leitch, the director of this film, to be doing. Mm-hmm. He's half the team that made John Wick, which to me is funnier than Deadpool because there's more of a purity to it. I mean, it's just as hyper-violent, but it's not commenting on its own hyper-violence constantly.
Right.
You know, so anyway, Chad Stahelski is making the John Wick sequels, and Leitch made Atomic Blonde, which we talked about last summer, and now this movie. Both of these guys are former stunt performers. So to take a guy who is used to doing all these remarkable things with his body and then to drop it into this heavily animated CGI environment where, you know, Colossus is throwing trucks at, well, Colossus is being thrown into trucks. Colossus mm-hmm. is a good guy. That's not so exciting. There aren't a lot of stakes in those physical confrontations when you know that your hero is a guy who has a Wolverine-style healing factor and cannot be injured. I think this style of humor works better for me in an Archer episode size, serving size of 22 minutes,
sure.
you know, versus 119 minutes. Didn't hate it. Would be quite happy to find it on the third slot of a triple bill at my beloved Benji's Drive-In Theater starting about midnight when you're tired and you might, you know, miss a few scenes because your eyes are getting a little drowsy and the fireflies are buzzing outside your car windows. So, B minus.
Huh, okay. I would actually push back against the idea of wanting to see it at a drive-in because I think the optimal way to see this movie is with a crowd of rowdies,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, this is a kind of communal, kind of shared transgression enjoying this movie because it is filthy, it is very violent, it is very bloody, and it is filled with the kind of jokes where if you are a casual comics fan or someone who, like I am, have been comics adjacent for his entire life, you pick up on the way the audience is reacting to those references. Mm. And so feeling just the energy in the room rise can sometimes be a fill-in for, I bet I would have gotten that if I'd read the comics or whatever. I think that with the first Deadpool, I felt like a lot of the fourth wall breaking, a lot of the meta humor, a lot of the constant kind of commenting on what's going on, kind of speaking to the audience, was papering over the almost complete lack of a plot. You know, it's a very shaggy movie. It's a relatively, for a superhero movie, a low-budget movie. And so watching it, I felt like, well, I've gotten jokes dispensed to me, but I haven't necessarily really engaged with any kind of stakes. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie, though there are still issues involving stakes, I don't want to spoil anything, this movie goes through more plot machinations, for better and for worse, and feels more like it's got a story to tell without really letting off the throttle on the sheer volume of jokes. At the same time, you wind up with a little bit of sequel bloat.
Yeah.
This feels more like a summer movie, and Deadpool 1
came out Valentine's Day weekend.
Came out in February. Right. Yeah. It ended up performing like a summer movie.
Yeah.
Box office wise, but was not seen.
Right. And I mean, that's the same weekend that Black Panther was this year. So it's like February is what June, 20th used to be.
No, the summer movie season now goes from Valentine's Day to July 4th.
Yeah.
But
I am all for a film that makes fun of superhero cliches because there's too many of them and they are eminently make funnable of. But, and I can feel the film going, you mad, bro? No. But here's the thing. If you're going to make fun.
He's mad, bro.
If you're going to make fun of superhero cliches, you can't choose as your triggering action the one thing you want us to take sincerely in your film.
Right.
The thing that happens at the very beginning of this film is the oldest, the dumbest, the most useless superhero cliche there is, and that's where you're putting all your emotional chips on? I mean, they do it, in one sense, to make some jokes during the credits that refer back to that. I get that. But it's like, that's not what...
For a movie
mad, bro.
You're mad, yeah. Bro. But for a movie that is commenting on so many tropes, yeah, to let that be the one that it doesn't really comment on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear that.
It's very strange. You know, there are... The screenplay here is credited to Reese and Wernick, and they probably have first names, and Ryan Reynolds. They also collaborated on the script for the first one, and I feel like it takes all these guys to equal one Shane Black. Like, that's the... The sensibility
you
that they're going for
but
here.
Then it would have to be a Christmas movie.
Yes, and I would welcome that.
You are a Shane Black stan.
I am.
And
Shane Black is channeling pulp detective fiction cliches in the same way that this movie is just buzzsawing its way through 90s Marvel revenge comics cliches,
right,
with the bulging muscles and ridiculously oversized guns and the ammo pouches everywhere. We do get a few quality jokes about the pouches that Cable is wearing and about Rob Liefeld's inability to draw feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I really am the target for this because I was like exactly 13 years old when all these, Todd McFarlane and Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld sort of took over Marvel Comics before all jumping ship at the same time. And I kind of lamented it. You know, I didn't like what it had done to comics. It made everything so, so aggressive.
Daisy, you're a big fan of the first one. So I wanted to ask this question of you. How necessary does this franchise feel now that Marvel movies have gotten funnier?
That's a good question. You know, I think that for me, what works about both of the Deadpool movies for me, and that I think helps the fact that I think you're very right, the first movie, there's not a lot of plot. It's just the dynamic between the characters, the relationships between them. And so for me, it's less about the jokes and more that I think what is also strong about the other Marvel movies is, again, the relationships between the characters. It's not that they always have the most interesting villains. It's the way that they interact with each other. So I feel like it's not so much that we need it to comment on things. We don't need it in that sense. But it is dirtier in a way that the other Marvel movies are not going to be.
Yeah,
so it's not so much that they need to be funny, but it does hit a type of funny that those movies will never go in that direction.
That's true.
And if you really do like vulgar, I mean, if you give me vulgar and heart, that's great. For me personally, because the only things I'm ever keeping in are things that I'm thinking would make other people uncomfortable. But I do it with care. And so in that sense, I feel like it hits that sweet spot for people. But to me, it's not so much that the other movies have gotten funnier. It just kind of hits this other place in the fandom that is still very useful. But I think the strength of all these movies is really just the way that these characters bounce off of each other. And I was glad to see them bring back certain characters in the second movie and develop them a little bit more. And I was frustrated by the beginning. That was probably my biggest frustration overall. But in general, I mean, that's what I love about the first movie is a lot of that dynamic between Wade and Vanessa, two wildly unhealthy characters that manage to have a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. That's my dream. So I might be saying too much about myself, but you know what I mean? Like, that's what worked about it for me. It's not just the meta jokes. It's that it's built on top of that.
Yeah, look, there is a hole in the market here that this is filling. The superhero genre is huge, so there are subgenres in it. There's grim and gritty, the Dark Knight films. There's big and spectacular, the Avengers films. And then there's this, which this shares some psychic real estate with Suicide Squad, in that it's powered by a kind of glib smarminess that is just, it's powered by this very facile, reflexive cynicism that's not coming from any place. It's just laid over everything that risks nothing. And that's just the attitude. And that's exactly what Chris said. That's coming from the 90s comics. That's exactly what they were about. That's who Deadpool is. My brother-in-law is going to eat this up. America's brothers-in-law. This is a film for America. You're going to be cornered at Thanksgiving, and he's going to say, there's that moment, right, where he calls Cable, he calls him Thanos. And I'll be like, yes, that happened. And he'd be like, that is not his name in this film. That is his name in an entirely different film. I'd be like, yep.
Got it. I got that.
But there is... To see superhero action result in death is logical,
right?
Right? I mean, if superheroes do not exist, if they did, people would die. And the notion that in Marvel superhero films, regular Marvel superhero films, that happens as a consequence, and it's not ancillary, it's not happening all the time like it is in these films, is you know, that's an interesting thought experiment that others can go on.
I just want to say quickly, I mean, we do know that these Fox X-Men movies, they are still a walled garden apart from the Marvel Studios, right, you know, shared universe Disney films. And they're trying to sort of police their own internal continuity in a much more haphazard way than the Marvel films have done. But I loved Logan, and I felt sort of targeted by the way this film opens with a big joke about, you know, Logan going for pathos. And I wrote my glowing review of Logan last year with Glenn and Linda in my mind sort of saying, like, superheroes don't need to be like this. They don't need to be sad. They don't need to be, you know, grim. They don't... And I just, like, that movie moved me so much. I felt the sense of sacrifice, the sense of loss, the sense of heroism that is entirely absent for this. So it's just a different thing that our rating can permit. And I like that the superhero genre is so evolved that it can exist in all these different permutations now, but the Logan model is the one that I think is more meaningful to me.
Oh, man. So sad, though.
Yeah. I know. I cried. I cried at Logan, and I only cry at Wes Anderson movies.
So. You know, the thing about Logan is that it's a Western.
And Creed.
It's a Western. Did you know that? You know that?
Okay. Now you're mocking me. That's fine. That's fine.
I did think, you know, to push back a little bit against Glenn's take on this movie, I did think that when this movie was funny, I thought at times it was extraordinarily funny.
Jokes, yes.
I thought, I mean, there is definitely stay for the credits.
Definitely.
Do not miss the credits. But also, like, there's an extended riff where he's assembling a super team and then attempting to deploy said super team that includes, among others, the great and good Rob Delaney.
Yeah.
Rob Delaney.
that I was just, for lack of a better word, I was just tickled by it. Mm-hmm. And there were times when this movie just tickled me, and I'm sure the movie would make a joke about that. But I did get a kick out of it. I also found maybe, and you guys can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but did you find that Deadpool's dialogue was so much sharper when his face was covered?
Uh-huh. What are you suggesting there, Steven?
I'm suggesting that this script was punched up to the hilt.
Yep.
And that they were able to drop in as many punched up gags as they possibly could. And it is where this movie plays into a real strength of Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, yeah.
And Ryan Reynolds takes a lot of crap for a lot of things. But Ryan Reynolds is, among other things, a tremendous voice actor.
Mm-hmm.
He is a very funny voice actor. I mean, there's a reason that you cast him as your race car driving snail in Turbo. because he can...
I did not expect that reference.
Oh, no. You know, you got to...
Sure, no, Deadpool, wherein the guy from Turbo plays a foul-mouthed mercenary.
I'm just happy that a reference made Glenn happy.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that this movie would know how to use Ryan Reynolds, but the fact that he is a funny voice actor plays right into the way that they dispense jokes.
I do think that this franchise really uses Ryan Reynolds to his best possible use. In general, I mean, think of what we know of Ryan Reynolds. He's not really hitting different beats than he's always hit. He's always kind of been the guy who could make a very kind of out of the side of his mouth comment and then get a little whispery and in anything, whether it's that show about a pizza place he was on back in the day or other movies he's been in where they're very actiony. I mean, it's not as straightforward, but it's as if he gets to indulge that part of himself 1,000%, and that part is legitimately there. He's not putting it on for these movies. I think that is another thing that works for me about this franchise. But in general, now that I'm thinking of it, I felt like I actually noticed it in the sound mixing a little bit. Like, yeah. I was like, all of a sudden, this joke is louder.
This dialogue was definitely recorded in a studio.
Yes, exactly. But also, I feel like with any movie, there's a lot of punching up that happens. Mm-hmm. I feel like with this one, it was probably not just that. You know, Ryan Reynolds is deeply involved in the making of these movies in a way stars are not always. And I feel like he was probably just like, I've got a better one. I've got a better one. Yeah. Like, it wasn't even necessarily that they were like, oof, you know?
But well, I mean, this is like an expensive Zucker Brothers movie, right? I mean, you can just throw in more stuff and it's not gonna, you know, it's not gonna shatter the delicate crystalline structure of the film that you've elaborately constructed over many months. No, you can just throw in another joke.
Just throw in the jokes. Well, you said it, Daisy. He's, Ryan Reynolds is indulged. The fact that he is billed as a producer and a co-screenwriter will tell you that he has been lavishly indulged. All right, well, we want to know what you think about Deadpool 2. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Microsoft Surface Laptop. At just under 3 pounds and with up to 14 and a half hours of battery life, Surface Laptop lets you binge watch your favorite shows whenever and wherever you want. Do more with Surface Laptop. Thin, light, and beautiful. Pop Culture Happy Hour is brought to you by the Showtime original series, I'm Dying Up Here. The drama series follows a group of young and talented comedians risking it all to make it big. They're each other's best friends and biggest rivals, making the fight for the spotlight more than a little complicated. Academy Award winner Melissa Leo stars as Goldie, the gatekeeper to fame who can make or break their careers. Don't miss new episodes of I'm Dying Up Here, Sundays at 10, 9 Central, only on Showtime. Watch the season premiere on YouTube for free now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week, buddy?
I've talked about the Santa Clarita Diet on Netflix before. It just recently got picked up for season 3. That is nothing but good news because, man, that thing is firing on all cylinders right now. It's a story of Timothy Olyphant and Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore becomes the undead and has to eat people. Wackiness ensues. But there is something about Timothy Olyphant's performance which I saw coming from nowhere. He is working at this kind of fever pitch as this person desperate to keep his family together. His comic timing, his delivery, the character, the writing, just the dialogue in the show is fantastic. And I would say Drew Barrymore, I mean, this is heresy, I suppose, but I mean, she was kind of the weak link because this ensemble is so strong. She was kind of the weak link in season 1. If you want to just pick up on season 2 and catch up before the next season comes up, you can certainly do that. That is the Santa Clarita Diet on Netflix.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Daisy Rosario, what's making you happy this week?
So, I am enjoying the remix of Arrested Development Season 4. Oh. I don't know if people are realizing that it's there, because obviously there was a lot of hype around Season 4 coming out, and then it was disappointing.
And then plop.
Yeah, and I don't know that I love it, but I have really been enjoying watching it, and one, I do think it is already funnier. It's definitely funnier.
Now, who has remixed it?
Mitch Hurwitz himself remixed it. So basically, he took the show and recut it into shorter episodes, so 22-minute episodes, more broadcast
big
length.
Big plus.
Yes. More episodes overall, since he had enough material to start with. And now it's in chronological order. Mm-hmm. So originally, you know, one of the big complaints about season 4 was just that it tried to do a different format thing where it followed individual characters. I appreciate people taking a chance, but the strength of that show is the fact that it's an ensemble show, so why would you split them up that way?
Because they weren't in the same room at the time, but yes.
Yes, exactly. So now you really do get the ensemble throughout, even if they're not all in the same scenes. In every episode, you do get more of a mix of that. I haven't finished it yet. I don't know that I love it. But in general, it's nice to revisit those characters and it to still actually feel like the show in a way that season four originally did not feel like it. And I love that show.
So now, as many listeners know, Arrested Development is coming back for season five.
Yes.
On May 29th. For people who maybe trailed off and didn't watch all of season four, should they just watch this remix instead?
I think so. I think if you want to watch season five, then yes, watch this remix instead. If you have moved on with your life, which is also
which
a totally
recommend.
Fine choice to make, then don't watch it. Because I think it will probably be very hard to pick up on what season five will end up doing. I mean, just mm-hmm. knowing what happens in season four, there's a lot that I didn't remember that is, I think, just more memorable now in the format it's being presented.
Yeah.
But they're going to pick up from wherever these characters leave off. So if you do know that you want to watch season five, definitely watch this version of season four. But if you are fine with things not coming back, continue your bliss.
Thank you, Daisy. Chris Klimek, what's making you happy?
The other thing that was happening in early 90s comics on the opposite spectrum of the hyper-masculine Marvel thing was the Neil Gaiman DC Comics, you know, pre-Vertigo fantasy thing with Sandman and some other titles. So I'm going to counter-program Deadpool and say what's making me happy is the other movie I saw yesterday before Deadpool, which is called How to Talk to Girls at Parties. This is an adaptation of a Neil Gaiman short story that appeared about 10 years ago. It's been adapted by John Cameron Mitchell of Hedwig fame.
Yeah.
This is set in 1977, the summer of punk. It concerns a guy who is, I think, exactly the age that Gaiman would have been then. He's played by Alex Sharp, who I think has been cast at least in part because he really looks like Neil Gaiman. Elle Fanning is a woman he meets on his adventures. He and his two buddies, they publish a fanzine called Virus, and they go looking for a party, and Steven, they find one. being a game and story, you can probably guess that there's some otherworldly sort of genre elements to this, and to go into those would be to spoil, but the film is completely charming and delightful. There is a warmth to the humor that is the perfect chaser for Deadpool. So if you don't want to go home at the end of the day with that acid in your mouth, you should watch them in the opposite order that I did. And watch How to Talk to Girls at Parties last. So I think this movie is rolling out. The DC release date is June 1st, and I think it may be coming out in New York and LA and some other markets sooner, but look for that. It is called How to Talk to Girls at Parties. The director is John Cameron Mitchell.
Yay. Thank you so much, Chris Klimek. So last week brought with it a piece of what seemed at the time like terrible, terrible news, namely the cancellation of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Now, we've talked about this show before. It's wonderful warm-heartedness. It was on Fox for 5 seasons. Its ratings were not great. And so Fox announced that it had been canceled, sparking an absolutely incredible firestorm of a mix of gratitude for 5 wonderful seasons, adoration toward the show, and fury toward the network that canceled it. And it seemed, as the week was winding down, like there was momentum maybe toward another network picking it up. And fans of the show had to wait less than 48 hours to find out that indeed NBC was jumping in and picking the show up for season 6. And had the show been going away forever, I guess I would say that I'm being made happy by the 5 seasons of the show that are sitting on Hulu right now being endlessly rewatched by me, but I am delighted to report that it is coming back on NBC. This is just one of the best, warmest, most comfort foodie shows around. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I'm delighted that it is sticking around. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Daisy at Run DMR, which I love that. And you can follow Chris at CT Klimek. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have a second and you're so inclined, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more folks to find the show. We will see all of you right back here next week.
Do you love trivia, puzzles, nerdy games, and humor? What about interviews with actors, musicians, and people from all walks of life? Yeah? Then join me, Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.